That too, yep. You know, we actually had a fall this year, so I'm not really minding the snow so much. It was the warm temperatures before it snowed, and there's like this, there's just ice everywhere. But all right, well, let's continue our study through Daniel here. All right, we're in chapter 8. Daniel has, in verse 2, seemingly been in a vision swept to the citadel of Susa. This is during the reign of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. He's not taken to Susa because God threw a dart at a board and picked a random city. Susa would eventually become the governmental capital of the Persian Empire, which is being represented by the ram here. So there's this ram with two horns, both the horns, one's longer, one coming up last, butting north, west, and south. Strong ram, nobody could withstand his power. And then a goat comes from the west, moving as if not touching the ground with one horn, and it struck the ram down and in his mighty wrath. Okay? As soon as the goat magnified himself, the horn on the goat broke off, and four horns grew in its place. So that's the vision. We've been covering that. If you go to Daniel chapter 8, verse 20, we get the interpretation of the vision. It says, "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms, which will arise from his nation, although not with his power." Okay, very accurate representation of how the kingdom of Greece conquered the Persians. Greece could not have done it without its commander, Alexander the Great, and that's why it says his kingdom, because he conquered. And then all of a sudden, he dies, and four generals take what is the kingdom of Greece after having just conquered Persia and split it between the four of them. So those commanders' names were Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Lysimachus took what would become known as Thrace. Cassander took Macedonia. Ptolemy took Egypt, and then Seleucus took Syria. So, and then we actually have, and this is all review, we actually have these events detailed in chapter 7 when the beasts are introduced, because the leopard represents the kingdom of Greece, and the leopard had four heads, right? So that would be similar to the four horns of the goat. Along with that, the leopard had four wings. So a leopard is fast in and of itself, but this leopard's really fast because it's got four wings, and we saw that come out in the vision with the ram not moving as if not touching the ground. So many of us familiar with this section of Daniel. I've told you guys a couple times now that it's one of my favorite sections in the Bible, just because, you know, I mean, it's eight verses, and really the prophecy is only five of the verses, and there's so much detail in there about the Persian and the Medo-Persian Empire, the way that it was formed, and the direction that it was expanding, and the direction that Greece came from, and that it was fast, and just all the detail embedded in there. Excuse me. I mean, that's really encouraging to me to, you know, know that God knew that these things were going to happen beforehand. So then the interpretation of that, that visions in verses 1 through 8, the interpretation of it is in verses 20 through 22. Now, actually attached on the back end here, the vision continues on. So the ram and the goat are in verses 1 through 8, but in verse 9, the vision continues all the way on down through verse 14. Okay, so then in verses 20 and 22, where we read the interpretation of the ram and the goat, the rest of the chapter is going to explain the rest of the vision as well. So that's what we want to start working our way through. Okay? So that's a quick review of what we covered last week. If you jump here to verse 9, where the vision continues, The goat has magnified himself after his victory, and he now has four horns. And what the vision is going to do is going to focus on one of those four horns. Okay? Sort of. Verse 9, he says, out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Side note here real quick. Probably not a good thing that this horn was arrogant enough to grow itself towards heaven. You know, that's never good. When mankind tried to reach heaven, you know, that happened in Genesis, right? Also, doubly probably not very good that some of the stars were able to fall. So the one thing you need to understand about this section is you are going to have tremendous persecution of God's people at the hand of this horn, but make no mistake, God's people are not innocent in the matter. Okay. You know, it's one thing for the horn to reach to the heights of heaven. That would be its arrogance. But the fact that it actually did it and then caused some of those who dwell there to fall, well, that's not good either. So keep that in the back of your mind. Verse 11, it magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the hosts. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him. And the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. On account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? And he said to me, 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to me, and I was standing. And when he came near, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, son of man, understand the vision pertains to the end of time. Now when he was talking to me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, and he touched me and made me stand upright. We'll stop there. So let's start working our way down through here. What we'll do is we'll use verses 23 through 27, those last few verses of the chapter, which are the interpretation of the vision, to kind of help us piece this together. So in verse 9, it says, out of one of them came a rather small horn. So, these four generals that divide up the kingdom of Greece after the death of Alexander the Great, okay, says from one of them. So, this wasn't one of them. What that tells us is some time has passed on, right? It didn't say one of those four. It wasn't Ptolemy or Lysimachus or Cassander, okay, or Seleucus, but from them. So whoever this horn is, he's going to be a descendant of one of the four horns, all right? Now, we're actually going to be able to narrow this down to, it's going to be a descendant of Seleucus. So of the four horns, from that nation that Seleucus took, that region of Syria, that's where this horn is going to come from. Now, I don't want us to be confused because we just spent a lot of time in chapter 7 talking about a little horn, right, that was uttering blasphemous things against God and waging war with the saints. We know for sure that the horn in chapter 7 is not the same horn in chapter 8. Any ideas how we would know that just quickly from historical context? The horn in chapter 7 broke off of which beast? Fourth beast. Fourth beast representing which world kingdom? Rome, right? This horn is an extension of which beast. In this case, it's going to be the goat, and the goat represents the kingdom of Greece. So we can't have the two horns being the same. If one horn is an extension of the kingdom of Rome, and this horn is an extension of the kingdom of Greece, they cannot be the same. Okay? Plus, the timelines just don't work. Because when we studied the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7, we saw that the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, was coronated, the consummation of the ages in Daniel chapter 7, right? Judgment was rendered against the kingdoms, and their dominion was stripped and given to Christ when his people received their kingdom. So that's new covenant language. That's church age language. And it made sense because that horn went on to make war with the saints. Okay? If this horn here is an extension of Greece, Rome has not come into power then. You see that? Historically, Greece would still be the world power because this horn is an extension of Greece. And Rome and its Caesars and its armies have not come to full world power. So how can that horn wage war with the saints when this is historically during the rule of the kings of Greece? Just can't, because Jesus came in the days of the kings of Rome, Daniel chapter 2 says. All right? So, you know, hopefully that makes sense, but it would be really easy if you were just reading through Daniel on your daily reading, back-to-back chapters, to think that this would be the same horn. It is not. Now, in verse 9, this horn is not budding, but it is growing, and it's growing in three directions. Only it's growing south, east, and then towards the beautiful land, which would be west. All right? I've got a little note here. It says, toward the beautiful land, and it says that it could literally mean Palestine. Nonetheless, this is a reference to Jerusalem. All right? So here's this horn, and he's growing east, south, and west towards Jerusalem. So that's going to be similar to the ram that was budding. This is showing us that this horn is growing and spreading, and his power is reaching in these directions. Okay? If we jump over here to verse 23, confirms for us, he says, In a latter period of their rule. So that confirms for us that of the rule of the four horns, this is going to be in a latter time, which means time has gone by. And then it says, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. Okay. This is a little bit of kind of where the message comes from this morning. But this description of this little horn matches the vision, right? Because here he tells us that there's this king that's going to arise a little bit later from the four horns, and he's going to be insolent, right? Well, that came out pretty clear in the vision. Because the first thing the horn does is he tries to grow himself to the height of heaven. Even so much that he magnifies himself as to be equal with the commander of the host of heaven, which would be God, right? So what do you know? We have another king that thinks he's a god, right? It seems to be happening, and it seems to keep happening here. And so he's going to be moving out. Now, he battles south, right? Which is going to be the region of Egypt. He battles east. Historically, the Greek Empire continued to war east against the Parthians and the Arameans, okay, and many, many more, but those would be the nations that are east. And then west would be Jerusalem. Now, there is one king who arose from the four horns, okay? His name was Antiochus Epiphanes, and he was from the Seleucus horn, right? And he was one king who took a special interest in Jerusalem. Okay, so when it says this horn took an interest in the beautiful land, there is a king that matches that description. Now, the Bible's not going to give us that name. Okay? So, there will be maybe a couple sections here where I'm very, very clear that the information we have comes from secular history. Okay? Just to add some extra info in here, the Bible's not going to name him by names. But what's interesting is the Bible does say is from those horns will come another horn. He will spread east, west, and south towards the beautiful land. Okay? There is a king historically who did that. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes, and he was very interested in Jerusalem. Does anybody know why? What? You kind of, there's probably a handful of you here who know how this story goes and how it ends. But why does the vision tell us he was particularly interested in the beautiful land? You see, Mr. Epiphanes was very widely known for his love of temples. Okay? Fancied himself an artist. Okay? Loved the gold bronze statues, the gold rings, the sockets, the fine weaved, you know, goat's hair. Loved it. And so that was something that he personally was very interested in. So he's known for his love of temples. The other thing, and Zeus, Jupiter, you figure out, you know, who you're going to plug in there. But he also really liked to go into these temples and to substitute Zeus, Olympus, his god, in place for whatever god that temple was constructed for. So that's what's going to end up happening, okay? We'll come back to some of that here in a little bit. But that's what draws this king to Jerusalem. So back here in verse 10, it tells us that, referring to the horn, it will grow up to the host of heaven and cause some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth and trample them down. Now, if you jump ahead to verse 24, 24 is going to explain this, telling us his power will be mighty, and it was, not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper, and will perform his will, and he will destroy mighty men and the holy people. So you see, he's powerful, he's destroying, but specifically holy people who have always been God's people. All right? So he's coming. Yes, did he go south to Egypt? Yeah. Did he go to the Arameans east? Yes. But he had his eyes set on Jerusalem. There's your stars, the host of heaven, the holy people, and he's waging war with them. So go ahead and jump back to verse 11 of the vision. He says, it magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. Jump ahead to verse 25. Okay, this is how the angel explains the interpretation. It says, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease, and he will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. So, all right, now we're starting to see glimpses of, like, he's going to be broken, and it's not going to be by human agency. So God must come to the rescue at some point. All right? So in verse 11, he magnifies himself with God. So he's very arrogant and insolent, right? First thing that the horn does is try to reach the hosts of heaven. And he removes the regular sacrifice from him. So I like the way that verse 11 translates this, okay? Because it says that the horn is going to make himself equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him. So whose sacrifices were they? They were God's. So they capitalized that him there, and they do a good job with that. So now we get another detail here, right? The horn sets his sights on Jerusalem. He's going to wage war with the holy people, right? And then he's going to influence temple sacrifice, is kind of what is going to happen here. If you jump back to Exodus 29, some degree or another, a lot of this stuff's been coming up recently, but just got some instructions here for the tabernacle. Exodus 29, let's look at verse 38. He says, "Now, this is what you shall offer on the altar, 2 one-year-old lambs each day continuously. The one lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other you shall offer at twilight." So just, you know, from Exodus, just quickly reminding us that there were regularly daily sacrifices that Kevin's done a good job of teaching us, that were offered in the morning and at night, on top of the gifts and sacrifices that were offered by the priest and the people, depending on, you know, what event or what was taking place, whether someone wanted to bring a votive offering or a free will offering or not. There's always something being sacrificed, burning on that altar. Something's going on. So this horn comes in, puts an end to that, all right? Is what the vision tells us is going to take place. And then he's going to destroy the temple. Okay. Well, you know, we're reading the interpretation here in the end of verse 8. And, you know, it's kind of making sense that a lot of this stuff's lining up. But this is the extent of the detail that the Bible gives us. Now, there is some stuff that's written by Josephus that's really interesting about this time in history. So, this is not from the Bible, but I want to read something to you really quick from a Jewish historian who is a little closer to this time. And just listen to this. So this is from his writings, the Antiquities of the Jews. It says, "When the king..." Now, in this particular section that I'm reading in chapter 12, the section 12, chapter 5, he doesn't mention Antiochus in this section by name, but he mentions him like a ton of other times during this period of time. So it's very well understood that this is the king. So it says, "When Antiochus Epiphanes had built an idol altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they paid to their own God, and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day." Now that's written by man. Okay? Just like America has its own history, and you've read a history book, that doesn't, you know, it's not like you can't read history books, you know. But doesn't that sound a lot like what we just read? There's this guy who's going to come. He's going to set up all these idols and altars so you can sacrifice to them, deciding who's going to be a god and who's not a god, which, by the way, he's God, because he's going to raise himself to be equal with the commander of hosts. And then he's going to stop the sacrifices of the Jews and then replace them with his own sacrifices, because he wants to put Zeus Olympus as God into that temple, which he's infatuated with. And the way to worship him, he's just going to sacrifice a bunch of pigs. Did the pig make it onto the clean list for the Jewish people? It parts the hoof, right? Isn't that, you know, for them land animals, the requirement is it has to part the hoof. What else did it have to do? Chew the cud. You know, what does that mean? You know, well, you know, my family's reading Charlotte's Web right now, and I don't remember Wilbur chewing the cud. Okay. But he did eat slop and the scraps that you see. You see, the pig parts the hoof, but it doesn't chew the cud. So the pig was unclean. So now many of you guys, you know, fresh off of Kevin's Wednesday nights, and even some of the stuff that Lorenzo's bringing out, like, I mean, just, I mean, I know sin is sin in the eyes of God, but you want to be insolent and arrogant, like Daniel calls this king, and you want to really, really rub it in the nose of God, you start offering pigs on his altar. Now, what I read's not written by God, so you decide, okay? But everything lines out, because Antiochus Epiphanes, who's recorded as doing these things, came from Seleucus dynasty, the kingdom, which was one of the four horns, and the timeline does match up, okay? Even the to a degree, even the 2300 evenings and mornings fit with Antiochus Epiphanes, so this is generally accepted as being him, although his name doesn't show up directly. You know, in other places in the Bible, it'll call Cyrus out by name, or you know, it'll call Nebuchadnezzar out by name, but it doesn't do that here, but it's still widely accepted as him. Yeah, John?
Do you have any insight on, in verse 24, where it says, but not by his own power?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes and no. So it's not going to be just him. Okay? So let's actually read that again real quick. Okay. Verse 24, his power will be mighty, but not by his own power, but he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. So what you have happening here is something similar to Sennacherib, king of Assyria. Okay? You have God's people worshiping other gods, and God warning his people repeatedly, and God's people unwilling to turn away from their idolatry. So God is willing to punish his people. And he does that by calling a king from an eastern country and allowing him to come through. Right? God did that. In Daniel chapter 2, when we saw the vision of the statue, he says, you, king of kings, or, you know, you're king of kings, you are the head of gold. To you, God has given dominion authority. Okay. World rulers never have power unless it's given to them by God. Right? So he's going to come in and he's going to be a big shot and, you know, all powerful and mighty. But at the end of the day, okay, he's going to think himself God, but the power he had wasn't his own.
And I think just to add to that, from the physical perspective, Antiochus was not the rightful king of the Seleucids. And so when he came to power basically by really crafty politics. Right. And being in the right place at the right time to make sure the right person died and he would be put in place. Yeah. So I think that's part of what that means, is that he wasn't like the announced and crowned king that was to follow. He came in and he took people out via intrigue to become king. So
yeah. when it says that the horn was going east, you've got the Parthians and the Arameans in that region historically, but he actually was battling against other Seleucus kings and other Greek empires, actually. There was a lot of infighting that was going on for a while. And you're going to see some of that stuff come out here a little more as well. So, John, does that cover that? Okay. So, yeah. You have... back here in verse 12. So I think the picture matches pretty closely here on what's going on. In verse 12, it says, and on account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. So here's where you see that the Jews aren't necessarily innocent in the matter. Okay. On account of the transgression of the host, will be given over to the horn. So this horn is coming to Jerusalem, causing all this chaos, and the Bible says that the host were given to the horn on account of their transgression. Now, you do any kind of reading, and here's how I'll say this. Again, this section does not tell us exactly. But what we do know from history, okay, because we're getting a little bit closer here to the time of Jesus. You know, we're not talking about 2000 BC, 1000 BC. We're getting a little bit closer here. The priesthood during this time had become a political nightmare, just like it was in the days when Jesus came to earth. Right? That same jockeying that you see inside the Seleucus Empire is happening in the Jewish priesthood. Right? So, for example, when Jesus came to earth, and then when the apostles started taking the gospel message out, how many high priests were there at that time? There were two. How many are there supposed to be? One. How does that happen? Politics, right? So here he tells us it was on the account of the transgression that the host was handed over to the horn in the first place. It tells you the Jews weren't innocent in the matter, all right? There's a ton of stuff written about that. It wasn't my goal today to read a bunch of that to you because I want us to try to stick as much to the Bible as we can. You guys, if you want, you can look into this stuff. Flavius Josephus writes a ton on it. But the priesthood was not in a good place. And the other thing that Josephus mentions is that the Jews were already beginning the process of accepting Greek culture, right? So you've got the Greeks who rise to power, and their influence is spreading over the whole world, right? A lot of the known world ends up speaking Greek. There's Alexandria's cities on every continent with the exception of Antarctica. Like, the Greek influence spread, you know, very broadly. Even so much so that when we read the New Testament, we have these Hellenistic Jews, which is, okay, that's a way of saying Jews who had grew up in Gentile regions under Greek culture, right? So you already have, Josephus tells us that a lot of the Jews were already starting to fall into the customs and the cultures of Greece, which maybe some of that stuff isn't all bad. It's the fact that it caused them to weaken their faith towards God. So then you end up with all of this jockeying and positioning for high priest that's going on and not necessarily doing everything right. And so God allows it to come. If you look in verse 13, I really, really want to get this done. He says, I heard the Holy One speaking, and another Holy One said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled. Okay. Verse 14, and he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. So I don't have myself like a super strong opinion here. Okay. It can be difficult to go back and to figure out, okay, how. When did this period begin? When did it end? The one thing that you'll notice, though, is when they're explaining the vision, they talk about the end, the end, the end. And what the vision is trying to show is a preview and a foreshadow to the end of the Jewish system of law. Okay? So when it says, you know, this vision's pertained to the end, it's not talking about like Revelation Judgment Day type stuff, the timeline doesn't match. So what you have here is you have the transgression, which has brought about punishment, and you have this preview and this foreshadow for the destruction and the end of the Jewish system. You have a putting to the end of the regular sacrifice. This stuff all comes out later. There's a few things here, particularly like in verse 11, that I skipped on purpose because we're going to see more about this in Daniel chapter 11. This interfighting between Seleucus and Ptolemy and some other things that were going on. Daniel chapter 11 is actually going to give us more information into that. Okay, and in my opinion, again, confirms for us that this is Antiochus Epiphanes, right? But he says, you know, the angel says, you know, well, how long? Well, it's going to be 2,300 evenings. Well, you know, I don't really have a super strong opinion here. I think there's a couple possibilities, but, you know, to me, it looks like the prophecy begins with Antiochus Epiphanes coming into town and persecuting the Jewish people, and then you have a period of roughly 6 years, and then when those pigs were no longer being sacrificed on the altar, and then the regular sacrifice was restored into the temple. Historically speaking, if you look at some records, that seems to fit pretty well. You know, if you have, another opinion, you know, you can share that. So, okay, let's see here. Well, here's a good cliffhanger, I suppose. So in verse 15, Daniel sees the vision, wants to understand it, and there was one who looked like a man. And he heard a voice of the man between the banks of Uli, and he called out and said, Gabriel, tell this man an understanding of the vision. You know, you see figures like that in the Old Testament, and your radar always goes up, and you're like, who is that? You know, like, could it have been Jesus? You know, well, you know. And, you know, so far what we read, I don't think you can really prove it one way or another. Now, when we keep studying Daniel, we're going to get a description of the angel, and then we'll start doing our homework then to kind of get a picture of who we think this could be. Gabriel's named, right? So we've got this other angel that looks like a man, which is not atypical of the way the angels present themselves in the Old Testament, right? But you have this angel, he looks like a man, and he tells Gabriel to tell Daniel, you know, what the vision means. All right. So we'll look at the description of the angel later. It's a lot of this information, we get more information later. And decide then. The one thing I will add is whoever this angel is that looks like a man, he's giving Gabriel charge concerning this matter. So I don't know if you want to, you know, Kendall Bible question this week, but you should try to find out what the Bible means when it says somebody is able to give charge of angels, okay, concerning things. And maybe that'll help you figure out who has the, how that language plays itself out and who has charge over the angels. So thanks for your attention, guys.